Microphone check. 1, 2. The microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2. The microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They knows I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my de-scrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Noam. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS Tazaruk. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson Owens.
And it's the 4th of February, a week that included both the State of the Union speech and Groundhog Day. And I won't do the obvious joke, unless you want to, Paul.
A couple of them popped to mind.
Well, exactly, yes. I like the one someone said that, the juxtaposition was ironic, and that one event involved the attempt to get some prognostication from a creature of extremely limited intelligence, and the other involved a groundhog. I don't know that we got much prognostication from a creature of extremely limited intelligence
in
the State of the Union.
Scott Simon took him seriously. The most intriguing part of his speech, apparently, was, and he talks to Republican congressmen on the education or the science committee. Was this idea of putting money into science education. That's just the most intriguing thing about the speech for Scott Simon. Maybe that is true because there wasn't much intriguing about the speech.
Well,
but I was struck by, going back to the Kansas speech, the Brokeback Mountain question got a lot of remark, but there was a question about education, and Bush showed up, and it was in, the Monday or Tuesday. Would have been the Monday night, the Monday Chicago Tribune. There was a column by a black columnist whose name escapes me. He recounts the interaction about education. Bush did not know $18 billion was cut off of the education out of student loans. He was just totally clueless, you know.
So why should he be concerned? That's not what his presidency is about, after all. Except in the sense of cuts.
He was going to a major university. You think he would get a question about it, perhaps, and they might have prepped him for it. But I guess they were so worried about how he was going to present the spying issue, which was what this Kansas KU, I guess it was KU, discussion was supposedly billed as, but he did get a couple of embarrassing questions. One of them, which was got a lot of play, and the other one should have gotten more. I'm not saying the Brokeback Mountain remark shouldn't, or unease shouldn't have been featured, but it seems to me the education budget, particularly when, you know, now he's talking about the need for, you know, better student education.
Well, there certainly is some indication that the White House, and by that I mean the central organs of the executive in this government, is in a great deal of disarray, and this may what you point to may just be another example of that. The State of the Union speech seemed to me remarkably thrown-together affair. Remember, for the week leading up to the State of the Union speech, what the White House was putting out was that it would be about health care and domestic issues, because, of course, they couldn't bring themselves to talk about the war, since the war was going so badly, but they said, no, the president will feature what his administration will be doing for health care, with a clear eye to the upcoming 2006 elections. We listen to the speech, and health care is mentioned almost not at all. Now, there's good reasons for the White House not to mention the Medicare drug business, which has been such a horrible failure, and people have seen it across the country to be a horrible failure. But we were supposed to hear things about individual health accounts and so forth, whereby the Bush administration would say, yeah, it really is going to do something about the health care crisis in the country, and we didn't. Instead, we heard addiction to oil, and the president's sort of madcap assertion that we want to reduce imports from the Middle East by 75%. And the next day, the administration rushed forwards and said, no, he didn't mean it. That was just sort of an example of the sort of thing we might do, but of course we're not going to do that. Now, Paul, this is bizarre. I mean, here's the State of the Union speech, which has come in recent years to be a major defining moment for an administration each year. I mean, sort of like the speech from the throne when Parliament opens, you know, where the announcement is what the government is going to do is set out. And instead, we get a prognostication from a creature of extremely limited intelligence that has been badly put together by his staff. Yeah. What's going on here? Yeah. These people are in complete disarray.
He should have had. He needs a queen to read his opening gambit.
Well, he tried, and that sort of galumphing comment about Laura Bush. They know that they're one of their best public. Elements, so to speak, is Bush's wife, and so that was sort of painfully
done. Talk about running
done.
Running her for the Senate somewhere, maybe Maryland,
which he immediately stomped on. Yeah. So, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, he doesn't want to be made look even worse.
Yeah, the disarray. I'm not sure if this really is part of it, but you know, the Iran issue and the IEA referral to the Security Council happened. I was looking around to see who's going to. They punted it into the next month, so. There was some talk about the design was to have Bolton be president of the Security Council, which he is. They give him the shortest month. You know, the U.S. just can't get no respect.
It's sort of like Black History Month.
Yeah, he only gets 28 days. It's not even a leap year, and they give him 28. And Argentina is going to be in the president's Security Council in the month of March, which is when the dossier will be referred about the Iran issue.
And they've been uppity recently, too.
Yeah, they certainly have. Uh-huh. And India, I guess, did vote for this. Last week I was talking about how the U.S. ambassador might have scuttled that by saying that, well, you know, sort of making it a quid pro quo that this earlier abridgment of the non-proliferation treaty where the U.S. offered aid to India for its civilian nuclear program in violation of NPT, the ambassador suggested that, well, if India doesn't go the way we want on Iran, we may hold that money back. So maybe and it caused a real brouhaha in India, and a lot of anger about that, about the U.S. imposing its way. But they did vote in favor. Maybe big money did talk after all.
Well,
but what I wanted to get to was this blank page, a good symbol of John Bolton. If you go through the UN website and look for the statement of the presidency page, there's only a header there. The whole page is blank except for the header that comes from the UN itself. I didn't click through any of the links to see how busy Bolton is, but it's either, you know, maybe this is incompetence and they just don't have the linking right, and that they do have some material for their discourse about their plans for the 28, maybe it was all about Iran, and they couldn't put
exactly.
it up.
That's right.
Because
yeah.
it was punted into the next month.
That's very possible. They may well have something to hide. I mean, you know, question of where the bodies are buried, quite literally. And I mean, the same sort of madness and disarray, you know, is coming out all over. Rumsfeld this week has been all over the media. I mean, the places he's gone, the things that he's said, and what's coming out of his mouth is sort of wildness. Iran is the world's greatest sponsor, state sponsor of terrorism. Now, you know, that's a very strange thing for, I mean, the Iran policy of the United States government does seem to be in a good deal of disarray, but it almost looks like the divisions within the administration have gotten so great that Rumsfeld has got to go, as it were, take his case to the public because he can't win it internally. Remember, Rumsfeld was lying very low, you know, through the winter as the war got worse, as things in Iraq got worse and worse, and now suddenly he's burst upon the scene with comments of bizarre nature. He's compared two world figures to Hitler this last week. First of all, Hugo Chavez is Hitler because they've got the embarrassing fact that in an American mythology, Chavez has to be painted as a dictator, but he keeps winning these elections. And Rumsfeld's response is, well, Adolf Hitler won elections,
it was
too.
On the anniversary of Hitler's election, actually.
And, and then Osama bin Laden is just like Hitler and Lenin, says Rumsfeld this week. I mean, it's, you know, strange things are going on, and I can't help but see some of this Rumsfeldiana to be a result of things out of whack in the administration.
The it may have been set off by this cartoon. You know, there's another cartoon issue. Do you know about this Tom Tolles?
Absolutely.
I don't know what the key word is on it.
Well, I can tell you. I've got it here in front of you.
Good. Anyway, Rumsfeld is the doctor over a quadra amputee is the image, if you, and you've got it. So I'll just. It may have set him off, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff all wrote letters to the Washington Post. It's this guy, Tom Tolles, and he's often in the local college paper. I don't know if they did run that or not. I haven't actually kept track of the college paper this week.
The we've been hearing an immense amount of stuff about how all those crazy Muslims, you know, are upset about cartoons that have been hearing in the appearing in the British in the European press.
Yeah, it didn't run in Britain though.
And repeated in various cartoons and repeated in various papers, including Le Monde, for example, ran cartoons on it. It's a dispute that has been much highlighted in this country. The American media have talked about it a good bit. There's been less talk about the fact that all the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, wrote a letter to the Washington Post objecting to a cartoon. Now, this is interesting on the face of it. I mean, that's the event. The actual cartoon that they were objecting to is, as you describe it, it's a line drawing of a soldier, a quadriplegic, in a hospital, bandaged up, and being visited by a Dr. Rumsfeld, who's scribbling on a form. And Rumsfeld says, "I am listing your condition as battle-hardened." That's the phrase that Rumsfeld had used to say one of the good things coming out of the Iraq wars. We've got all these battle-hardened troops. Mm-hmm. So here's a quadruple amputee, you know, and he's being listed as battle-hardened. And at the bottom of the cartoon, a smaller figure of the doctor adds, "I'm prescribing that you be stretched thin. We don't define that as torture." Close quote. Now, here is the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, trying to run an aggressive war, you know, presiding over war crimes in the Middle East, and taking time off to write a joint letter signed by all six. It's almost like WEFT, you know. Everybody gets you get six people together to sign it in order to make it seem more official.
Moving right along.
I'm referring to the dispute at WEFT about a banning of a member of WEFT, and six committee chair at WEFT signed this, you know, to make the banning of the WEFT work the WEF volunteer, look more official. It's a scandal, and it's a scandal that should be talked about at some point. But we're talking about a much larger one right now, and that is the fact that Joint Chiefs of Staff write to the Washington Post saying they shouldn't have published this cartoon. You quote, using the likeness of a service member who has lost his arms and legs in war as the central theme of a cartoon is beyond tasteless. Close quote, say the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Now, you said that you pointed that there wasn't much coverage. ABC did have it, and they interviewed the cartoonist, and his report was they shouldn't waste their time writing letters.
Exactly.
They should do something about body armor in Iraq, mm-hmm. which is one line.
Well, ABC, that speaks well to ABC right now because they're making much of the fact that their correspondent, I mean, their anchor, his life may have been saved by the body armor he had.
Huh? Yeah. Cheney's making a big deal out of, he was on Limbaugh this week, the day after the State of the Union. He may have actually got more listeners on Limbaugh's show than the State of the Union address. I actually haven't researched the numbers.
That's a good point.
But I happened to tune in, and I heard his lovely voice, and listened a while, and he was saying that he was through the same region where was hit with a shrapnel to his head.
Mm-hmm.
And reminded me of when contemporaneous to that visit, his only visit to Iraq, I pointed out that from the coverage I did see that he was asked a question by an officer in Iraq saying, "I don't see any improvement. I don't see the advancement that's going on." And Cheney answers that he should read different papers.
Yes,
he shouldn't believe what he's reading in the paper. It's just absolute height of idiocy, as well as he's fixed in mind. He gets the same answer to everybody, and the idea that he's telling a officer who's on the ground in Iraq that he shouldn't, form his opinion about Iraq from reading the papers when he has some misgivings about the lack of progress is just beyond belief. Obviously, it's a point that didn't come up in the Limbaugh-Cheney tete-a-tete that happened, I guess it would have been Wednesday. Well, for the transcript of that, he sells it, so you can't get it. And nobody else seems to have gotten on to that yet, not Media Matters or any other groups.
Rumsfeld gave a speech at the National Press Club this week, in which he said the biggest problem about the war right now was the coverage it was getting for the press. He says, after all, the other side doesn't get criticized by the press, and yet we do. As you say, mad stuff. The problem was that the American press was not giving a good account of what was going on in Iraq. That much is true, but not in the way that he means it. The notion that American press should be busily criticizing the insurgency or the people that the Bush administration says it's fighting in what they are now wanting to call the long war, was the burden of Rumsfeld's speech. Amazing.
Yeah. The battle-hardened remark came out in Rumsfeld's response to a couple of studies, one internal, one external, to the Pentagon that came out with some rather grim analysis of the state of the U.S. Army and the quadra amputee isn't a bad metaphor. I regret to say that's the other thing that cartoonist said. This is difficult. This is a difficult thing to address.
Now, the Pentagon was actually doing some other presentation of its case this week, once again, perhaps because the State of the Union speech was so unsuccessful, apparently, in making the case the administration wants to make. A number of conservative columnists and the editorial writers of the Wall Street Journal and so forth all leapt into the commentary on the State of the Union speech to say it was a bad speech, that the administration had not properly presented its case for the long war. so Rumsfeld sailed into the breach and gave his discussion of the Long War in several venues this week. National Press Club, the annual Munich, Germany Security Conference, and several long interviews. Also, at the same time, there was the presentation of the Quadrennial Defense Review. Every 4 years, the Pentagon puts forward a general war plan, and that was presented this week on Friday, interestingly, but it was presented this week, and the burden of the Quadrennial Defense Review is that the military needs more special ops and psyops, special operations and psyops, in other words, guerrilla-style fighters and psychological operations to deal with all that nasty press that the U.S. is getting around the world out there. And the new budget for 2007 will be presented on Monday, and that budget obviously takes in the sorts of considerations that led to the Quadrennial Defense Review, and asks for $439 billion for the military, a substantial increase from last year. Now, that's new war money, we might say. That doesn't include the old war money, being the war that's being fought in Afghanistan and Iraq right now. And for that, the Bush administration asks for $120 billion. So this is essentially a almost a $560 billion request from the administration for its long war. Rumsfeld, at the outset of the attack on Afghanistan, was asked by a reporter when Americans would know that the war on terrorism how Americans would know the war on terrorism was a success. And Rumsfeld's reply, this was 4 years ago, Rumsfeld's reply was, Americans will know the war on terrorism is a success when they learn that it is a long war. So he's picked up that long war comment from 4 years ago and makes it clear that the real object of the war on terrorism, is the American populace. You have to convince the American populace that we need a war against, I noticed the administration is picking up Christopher Hitchens' phrase, Islamo-fascism, or as Bush said in the State of the Union speech, radical Islam. But the excuse of fighting a long war is used primarily to produce the effects that the administration wants amongst the American populace, because in fact their numbers are going down the tubes.
That is so amazingly Orwellian. When we know the war is over. When you know the war will always be on.
That's exactly right, Paul. I mean, many people talk about the fact that Orwell's 1984 just was placed 20 years too early. Mm-hmm. We've always been at war with East Asia. Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned the PSYOPs and the cycle operations. The National Security Archives has gotten some Freedom of Information action, and it's about the Pentagon's own studies of their psychological operations and the blowback phenomena, which we've talked about here, the idea that they paid for stories in Iraq about how good things were going, and then it was picked up in the press here. You know, here I've heard people say there's no evidence of a direct linkage as yet, but I'm sure, you know, they were studying it themselves, and they were saying they weren't doing anything wrong because that wasn't their intention. Now, the blowback was incidental, but the National Security Archives has gotten a whole lot of stuff. I can't confess I haven't read it all yet, but
they're invaluable, aren't they?
Doing some great work.
They really are. This National Security Archive, their name is, I think, in a way, unfortunate, because, of course, NSA, National Security Archive, I mean, the letters are occupied, so to speak. But in any case, the National Security Archive is a private group. It is, in fact, associated with George Washington University, which continues to give them a local habitation and a name to, you know, I'm not quite sure how they manage that, but they've been there for a while. And what they do is simply publish documentation of what the U.S. has been doing and what the U.S. is doing, and it's immensely valuable.
Well, it was given to them. They named themselves pre-Google, so this couldn't be a plan of theirs.
Oh, they've been around for... Oh,
yeah, I know, but the point I'm making is that if it might actually...
Oh, I see.
They might actually show up in searches for people that are actually looking, you know...
People put in NSA thinking they want those national security...
and they might read something that they wouldn't have normally searched for.
That's true.
And found out Consequently, the keyword idea might be inadvertently good. So, yeah,
good point. There was another document that is much being much talked about elsewhere and not being much talked about here, released or at least commented on this last week. There's keyword. This is what it's coming to be called now, the White House memo, parallel to the Downing Street memo. The White House memo refers to a document that has been reported on, but apparently not seen by too many people yet, giving an account of a discussion between Bush and Blair in the White House on January 31st, 2003, in which, amongst other things, Bush says, well, let's fly some planes marked with UN markings over Iraq and hope that Saddam Hussein will shoot at him, so we'll have an excuse for the war.
Belly, yeah.
Now, the point is that, I mean, you know, this sounds the sort of craziness that people associate with our chief magistrate, but the actual memo, as related in a book called Lawless World by Philip Sands, a British lawyer and professor of international law. This is the second edition of his book. He has been tracking this sort of stuff the same way the National Security Archive has.
He added a whole chapter about this Washington memo.
Because what the memo shows is that here Bush and Blair, at the beginning of 2003, already had the date for the invasion of Iraq, and were going to go ahead regardless of what happened at the United Nations, and indeed regardless of what happened in the House of Commons. Blair is agreeing to that, too. So the memo is causing a good deal of scandal in Britain as well. It should be causing more scandal here, Paul.
Yeah.
If we didn't, anyone who's looked at it knows perfectly well that the Bush administration was planning to invade a relatively defenseless country, regardless of what happened and regardless of the objections that could be raised under international law and under American law. They were going to do it anyhow, and they were saying they were going to do it anyhow.
This was a U-2 plane, and the idea was that if you flight it at its typical flight, it wouldn't have been assailable by the Iraqi air defense, so they would have to purposely flown it low, and they were going to fly it with a fighter squadron so that it would be
and with UN
target.
Markings.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
So, you know, it didn't go anywhere, but it shows how far they were willing to go. I was going to cite, I don't often recommend people go to Buzz Flash, and I guess I won't now, because they had a link to Channel 4 coverage of this issue and with an interview with Philip Sands and some other people. But I think they got so much traffic on it, they took it down.
Is that
so
right?
I don't know. I looked through the BuzzFlash site, and it was on the splash page right at the top, and I couldn't find it at all. So I think Channel 4 said, hey, take it off, or yeah, servers are
very
going
interesting
down. I'm pretty sure that's what happened to it.
Well, my sources for this are the account in The Guardian and in the Financial Times. Mm-hmm. I mean, the British papers have covered it. American papers,
yeah,
so far,
had
I
story
have
on it
not.
I think and, Guardian was first on it.
So it's, but I mean, this is, you know, in any well-run society, this is a smoking gun at least as serious as the Watergate memos that led to Nixon's resignation. Mm-hmm. I mean, we should be hearing about resignations from Washington of magistrates engaged in illegal activity, and we're not.
Tim Downing is not operating too up to great. You know the story about how they lost the education vote. Carl, they lost it by one vote, and guess who wasn't there?
Oh, right.
Tony Blair.
Yes. Oh, Blair. Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, you're talking about the House of Commons.
He was absent from a vote. I don't know whether the backbenchers actually committed to, and they didn't worry about it, whether they played a game on the whip that was supposed to be counting the votes, and they thought they had it, and then they turned around and stabbed him in the back. That might be a scenario. It was total incompetence.
There's a suggestion that the woman who runs the office for Labor, whose job it is basically the equivalent of the whip, the job to count votes and so forth, you know, that she will not be in her present job for much longer.
That
the British papers had fun with
it. That's a signed position. It isn't like the minister portfolio with education.
No, it's a party position. Yeah, it's a party position, Labor Party position. You know, their job is to muster enough votes so that they pass these bills. And Blair's being absent for a vote. I mean, the thing was, the bill had been watered down substantially from what Labor wanted anyhow, and what Labor wanted was pretty bad. So, you know, you wonder
well,
whether...
Yeah, well, there's two Labors now,
whether
you can't really say what Labor wanted at this point.
I'm talking about the Labor Party. I mean, the party as run by Tony Blair.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's possible at least that this was a way to...
back off of it?
Yeah, you get to back off of it. But
it's too embarrassing a way to do it.
I think that's right, and I think it's more likely
they
that
would have
this
just withdrawn the vote. Or
I mean, they had taken a lot of heat on this bill, and indeed they should have, so it may be over. But, it's the British political system is odd in this way because they have the idea that Tony Blair also is a lame duck executive in the same way that Bush is, or even more so. And the result is this the gathering of various and sundry forces around or opposed to him in other places. And I don't know.
It's strange
local stuff.
More analysis of the State of the Union in his speech than it probably warranted, but then he is the president after all. What is this? What is the biblical allusion in the very end about finishing well? Do you know anything about what that's supposed to be? More code language for evangelicals or something?
I don't know. I don't remember the phrase in the speech, and I don't know what the reference was.
Yeah, something about how you have to finish well.
You're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Easterbrook and Paul Muth talking about the news of the week and its coverage by the media.
I only went to one Kathy Kelly event this week. She was in town. Well, the most incidental thing I discovered a young student who had never heard of Halliburton. I was a little shocked by that, but I guess I shouldn't be. Another young woman student suggested Kathy Kelly presided over this role-playing game where we had parallel situations of an Iraqi man joining the police force and having a neighbor argue him out of it, and then there was a guy that was going to go work as a contractor for Halliburton who had a neighbor that also wanted to argue out of him. And it's an interesting phenomenon. But in the process, I discovered this guy that was playing, the guy that was going to go work for Halliburton in real life had never heard of Halliburton.
Uh-huh.
So, and a young woman said, well, why doesn't he just take his family along if there's a problem?
Mm.
So that was a little indicative of some ignorance in over at Unit 1. I was surprised.
And what that means is that there should be more things on campus and in town in general talking about basic information about what the U.S. is doing, what we're responsible for. After all, it is supposed to be a government run democratically, and therefore what our leaders are doing is something that we, in some sense, should have to answer for.
Kathy Kelly got busted in North Carolina recently.
Mm-hmm.
There's a website where you can read about it, stoptorturenow.org. This was on the site of Aero Contractors, who operate something like 18 planes out of Smithfield, North Carolina, and they are involved in extreme rendition, whatever you want to call it.
Yes, it's been.
Whatever euphemism. And they did an action there, nonviolent civil disobedience action, drawing attention to the fact that despite various denials at press conferences and et cetera, the U.S. is still probably, as an action of its state, is still torturing, but it's also still rendering people to places where they might be worked over in a variety of ways.
Kathy Kelly is quite a remarkable woman. You can read her book about going from Baghdad to a Peking prison, where she spent some time for civil disobedience.
Illinois, let's be clear about that.
That's right.
Yeah.
She is part of a group called Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And you can pull up their website. They're based in Chicago. And you pull up their website to see some of the actions that they're involved with, including an ongoing action in Washington to begin in 2 weeks and run until the middle of March. This is an important group, and she is quite an admirable woman. So I recommend Voices for Creative Nonviolence, their website.
Well, we could do some corporate malfeasance for a while. I guess we could do it the rest of the hour if we wanted to. But
probably wouldn't have any trouble filling up the time.
Have a little taste of it. ExxonMobil, how many billion was it this time?
They're having trouble counting. I mean,
this is something I haven't heard anywhere else, but they're making about $11 per barrel profit. So at $70 per barrel, that means at $238 out on the shelves right now, unless they've snuck it up again, that means that 35% of what you're paying on your gallon of gas every day is the absolute profit of the of the oil companies, apparently.
So. Well, you remember that the president explained this week that, after all, these prices were simply set by the marketplace, and there wasn't anything they could do about the fact that Exxon was doing very nicely, thank you, and that the other oil companies are too, apparently.
So he must have some misgivings about the whole situation, though, since he's one of the few Texas oilmen who ever never made any money on oil. He's always lost money, even even when he got inside knowledge about getting out of. What was the name of that company?
Small company? Ambrusco or whatever it was?
No, something with an H. Anyway, he got tipped off to get out of that early.
Oh, right. Yes, that was yes.
And he still was just saving what he what he could, as opposed to making a bundle.
Well, I mean, remember that the Bush's personal history may not really be terribly important here, but you know he does have an unbroken record of failure. From the original oil company he established, that was the one, the Spanish for Bush or whatever, up through the baseball episode and on to the insider trading that apparently saved his stake in the situation you were describing, and now down to the amazing. Chaos that they've produced in Iraq. I mean, it is really quite astonishing that things have gone so amazingly badly there. We had this fellow Robert Stein this week plead guilty to a $2 million theft while he was an official of the CPA. Yeah, exactly. I mean, $2 million, I mean, that might be something. Well, that's not important to you, Paul, but it might make a significant dent in my bank account. When we figure that we know for a fact that at the same time $8.1 billion was going missing, Stein's measly $2 million is hardly a drop in the bucket there. And we know that $8 billion is far less than the incredible amount of money that's been spent on this war, recently estimated by the former economists of the World Bank at close to $2 trillion. And they've made such a horrible job of it. I mean, the Germans had far less trouble occupying France than the Americans have in occupying Iraq, and Iraq was a prostrate country. There was fighting this week in Iraq, in Sadr City, between the Mahdi army, the Shiite group that the U.S. is counting on, in part, to form part of the government that we've tried to set up there, and shooting broke out between the Americans and the Mahdi army there, and there was even one report of a helicopter rocket strike in Baghdad, in the middle of Baghdad, Sadr City. Mm-hmm. So it's a complete screw-up. It's amazing how little it's talked about, and it's unfortunately par for the course for George Bush, I guess.
It reminds me that I was making the comment, and it's worth repeating, that Bush and all Condi Rice suggesting that a political party shouldn't have a militia when they were talking about Hamas, but then almost it's the exceptional political party in Iraq that doesn't have a militia.
Astonishing. And the, you know, we also didn't hear much about spreading democracy to the Middle East in the State of the Union speech this week. One of the reasons being, of course, that some democracy did actually spread in the Middle East, and that was the election of Hamas in the Palestinian parliament.
Well, I disagree. He made a very high profile applauding of the Egyptian elections, which are just, you know, which is just incredibly.
And
laughable.
Somehow didn't mention the much more
No, he didn't. He went on to mention Hamas's victory, and he said, but they have to change their ways.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So that's right. But this is not an example of the democracy we're promoting.
But the idea of the Egyptian elections is some kind of progress.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course.
When you have to get signatures of not your constituency to get on the ballot, but signatures of the currently elected officials, I mean, that is absolutely absurd, and it should be laughed out of the... But, you know, they're just saying that, you know, the U.S. has always been supporting democracy, clearly.
Yeah, of course.
I mean,
that
the evidence
goes without
is
saying.
Clear.
Right.
Well, Deterring Democracy, Chomsky, when was that written, I guess?
Early 90s, wasn't it? But remember now, I mean, here in the United States, we're coming up to elections for the House of Representatives Congress in the fall, and of the, I mean, 95% of the seats in the House of Representatives, you know, are safe seats. They won't change. It's the system is so stacked that the folks who are holding those seats don't have to worry about them. And only about 5% of the seats in the House of Representatives that are open, maybe two dozen tops. You know, they're concerned about that. But, I mean, these numbers would have been perfectly acceptable in the Bulgarian parliament in 1958, you know.
I'm going to repeat this again, too. Sorry for people who already heard it, because it's worthy of note. There was a recess appointment before the turn of the year of a Hans von Spakovsky to the head of the FEC, the Federal Election Commission. You know, there were 17 recess appointments at that time, and I haven't investigated all of them. But this one would have been interesting if it had to go before the Senate to be confirmed, because this guy was right in the thick of the 2000 Florida election boondoggle, swindle, whatever you want to call it. Is a member of the Federalist Society, who believes that the U.S. probably, he's probably one of the ones of the Federalist Society that believes that we aren't a democracy, we're a republic. That people in the Federalist Society are known to say that kind of thing. And
Afraid of democracy, that's all.
Yeah, well, and he's for the Georgia photo ID requirement, and he's a former Republican Party chairman in Georgia. And he's the kind of guy that wouldn't have, maybe would have gotten some embarrassing questions at the Judiciary Committee or whatever committee in the Senate would have been, had portfolio to ask about who's going to head the FEC.
While we talk about elections and democracy in this country, we might note in passing that the Patriot Act was extended for another month. Until they can get it right, you see, they've these temporary extensions, so from early February to early March. But the act as presently drafted has some interesting things that have been sort of quietly inserted into it. One is a definition of special events of national significance. The Patriot Act says that at things designated special events of national significance, and the designation is to be done by the Secret Service and the FBI, at such events, protesters can be charged with felonies if they protest in the areas that described as free speech areas at special events of national significance. Now, these will turn out to be presidential speeches in public. You notice that Bush isn't able to speak at anything except military bases and in tightly controlled circumstances.
It's already in effect, apparently, because T-shirts are not allowed in.
Well, as Cindy Sheehan pointed out, was pointed out in regard to Cindy Sheehan at the State of the Union address. But this establishes protesting, untoward protesting here as a felony, and puts into place what, as you say, Paul, has been the practice in recent events in this country. I mean, this is the sort of stuff that's crawling into the Patriot Act, and there was plenty of stuff under the rock in there already. So.
Yeah. The ACLU's got that wicked ACLU has a page on the exclusion zone controversy, and that's one of the things they're really, one of the many, I guess, in the Patriot Act. The thing is that the sunsetting ones are just the ones that they're arguing about. The other provisions are apparently A-OK already. And
Yes, there's plenty of bad stuff in there, too. The ACLU also has a very funny ad, from the sublime to the ridiculous here, a very funny ad about information, data mining, and so forth. It's set up as a pizza ad. It's a telephone conversation. A guy calls to order a pizza, and they know all about him. Cleverly done. You can get it at the ACLU page. I look for the reference to pizza.
Like they already know he likes pepperoni, of course.
That's the very least. That's the very least that they already know.
Well, we did start on... I wanted to at least acknowledge the Enron trial. What's illegal is what's not illegal is the scandal, and what they're not being tried for. Some of which is illegal, but they're still not being tried for it. The ripoff in California, where they were purposely putting power plants offline for quote maintenance, just so they could jack up the price in the new fluid market they have. Isn't probably going to come up now. Maybe it will. I don't know. I don't, because this is what these this isn't what these Shell hiding the debt kind of legal fictions they were making up were about. This was Enron itself that was doing it. The famous remark about ripping off Grandma Millie, we're going to put it to her again, et cetera, et cetera. That's not on trial with Enron. And neither are there malfeasance in India and other things like that, which Arundhati Roy, I believe, does some chapter and verse on in Power Politics.
While we're talking about upcoming trials in the U.S., we should mention that the Libby trial has been scheduled. This refers to Scooter Libby, the vice president's aide, who is charged with various crimes, including perjury before the grand jury. But what mainly he was doing was trying to construct a propaganda facade for the Bush administration. Now, many people hope that the trial would occur before the full elections, because, of course, the trial is about what the Bush administration is doing and has done. The judge this week put off the trial to the 7th of January, 2007, comfortably after the midterm elections. And his reason for putting off the trial, which, as I say, the prosecutor wanted to have in place before the election, his reason was that one of Libby's lawyers has a conflict.
Well, there's also I don't know if he cited it as well, but the prosecutor that was operating this. Oh, that's Fitzgerald.
That's
I'm
Fitzgerald.
Sorry.
Yeah, this Abramoff. Is another matter. Yeah, we'll come to that. We'll come to the Abramoff stuff. Yeah,
I'm confusing my trials. Abramoff. They're so myriad.
Well, yeah. it's important to see what's going on here, because they are moving heaven. The administration is moving heaven and earth to make sure that the embarrassments of these trials be as limited as possible. Now, in fact, on announcing that the Libby trial would be postponed until after the elections, the judge also released some of the materials from the prosecutor, including the information that showed the prosecutor now thinks that Libby was engaged in a much broader attempt to mislead and propagandize the press in the matters of the run-up to the war, and so we may in fact hear some more from that. Original indictment had to do with what Libby had done before the grand jury, lying there. Now it's expanded, and a suggestion that there are a good deal more to the case. So eventually it may be worthwhile.
Fitzgerald, getting the prosecutors right, made an announcement that there's some emails referred to in various discourse that he has on oath from Miller and some other people that have vanished.
The White House destruction of evidence, yes.
You know, was not very forthcoming, apparently.
Right.
Fitzgerald, to turn the pressure on, I suppose, has announced it publicly. I don't know.
Exactly right. Alberto Gonzalez, or the Attorney General, or actually he was White House counsel at the time, ordered that all these emails relating to this matter be saved. Well, the Vice President's office said, you know, we're not going to be kicked around by a White House counsel, and therefore, apparently, they destroyed these emails, and now the prosecutor has that. Yes, and also, to move on to the Abramoff case, it looks like that the administration's attempt to put the lid on that may result in another special prosecutor for that case, and if that's true, that would probably be a good thing, eh?
I don't know. It depends on who they pick for special
prosecutor,
I guess.
Well, better than having
Fitzgerald's a little too busy.
An in-house one, yes. Mm. Mm. We're talking about the events in the war in Iraq. An interesting thing surfaced this week is really quite worrisome. A member of the European Parliament, a British member of the European Parliament, a Green as it happens, announced that there is a campaign about the deaths of some 250 Iraqi academics, people who have been killed in Iraq since the American invasion. It calls for an inquiry into how this has happened. I mean, these are people who have been murdered in Iraq since the U.S. invaded the country. And his suggestion, well, it's not the suggestion of the MEP who was proposing the campaign. But the notion here is that what we're seeing is something on the order of the U.S. Phoenix program. During the Vietnam War, the U.S. had an assassination team presided over by Colby, who eventually became head of the CIA, and their job was simply to go out and kill people, to sort of decapitate the resistance, to find people that they thought might be worthwhile assets for the other side and kill them. Yeah. And they killed some 23,000 people in the course of the Vietnam War, these murder and assassination by American forces. The suggestion, the implication of this campaign that's being put forward is that something similar is going on in Iraq.
Mm. In the last 7 or so minutes, I wanted to return to the Iran thing and the IEA. Two pundits that the NewsHour on last night predicted that there was no chance in heck that the this language about the broader Middle East being denuclearized would be included. Well, the U.S. compromised on it. In NPR, they said it was Egypt that was advocating this, and they would vote for it because they got it. I don't think Egypt has that much sway. They'd like to have them on board. One of the commentators on the NewsHour said it was the non-aligned movement that was calling for this extra language. I really think that some of the big guns in the Security Council, like Russia or China, also insisted that this language be included because the U.S. desperately didn't want to have it. The peculiar thing I saw in the Jerusalem Post on this coverage was they were recounting that this language about the denuclearizing of the Middle East and then said indirectly including Israel. It's like,
wouldn't
indirectly including
yeah,
Israel?
Uh-huh.
I was a little struck by that.
Yeah, right,
it's like,
right.
It sounds like directly to me as opposed to indirectly.
Well, the U.S. is, it's an interesting case, you know, because of the various wheels within wheels. I mean, the U.S. is at the point now of having the result of its $2 trillion war in the Middle East be the establishment of a relatively self-conscious and armed Shiite area, including Iraq, Iran, and possibly even the Shiite areas of Saudi Arabia. I mean, this is not a result that they look for, but the U.S. attempt to try to make its writ run throughout the region is becoming increasingly convoluted. We began by talking about how Rumsfeld has been running around all week saying increasingly crazy things. He probably reached a height when he said that the real problem that we're dealing with, the reason we have to continue to fight this long war, is that our enemies want to establish a global Islamic empire. A global Islamic empire, that's his phrase, and the question is, whose way of life will prevail, theirs or ours? And so they have to connect Iran into the whole understanding. Exactly, it's monolithic.
It's like the Cold War language.
Iran has to be connected to Al-Qaeda, to Saddam Hussein, to the whole business. Yes, it's exactly the attempt to reestablish the Cold War now under a new name and new management. No, it's the same old management, actually. The new name is the Long War. But just as worldwide communism had to be fought in the Cold War, so the global Islamic empire, that's Rumsfeld's phrase, the global Islamic empire has to be fought in the Long War. Now, in fact, the most extreme statements of Al-Qaeda figures, you know, have been that they want to get American troops out of Islamic Holy Lands. Mm. Okay, that's quite the global Islamic empire that Rumsfeld's talking about, but Rumsfeld needs the war and needs the enemy, so he's constructing it.
Yeah, well, you can find Wahhabi discourse about reinstating the caliphate and that kind of stuff if you want to, but you can also
after Connecticut, Paul.
Yeah, you can also find Ann Coulter in the local papers here saying that, you know, we should Christianize the Iraq. That would be a good solution to the issue as well.
And more importantly, that outside of the various groups described as Al-Qaeda, whether rightly or wrongly, I mean, there is a major sentiment throughout the Arab world that says, yes, they don't want the corrupt governments that the U.S. backs, and they do not want the U.S. Exploiting and controlling their country. That's not a particularly radical sentiment, but the sentiment is pretty general throughout the region, and it's concentrated certainly in Iraq, where they would be very happy to see the Americans go, but it's to be found elsewhere as well.
Oh, we didn't officially make the bet, but But Barack Obama did vote for the filibuster, but I still have incredible criticisms of how he did it. He did it and then announced how nobody worked on persuading people. Well, you know, he was one of the people that didn't persuade people, and he had a particular position where he would have been able to say, this guy is terrible on voter issues for African Americans, a lot of different issues for African Americans. I'm getting apoplectic here about Byrd, too. Byrd, I read his speech that he gave when he announced that he was going to vote for Alito, not even thinking about a filibuster. Two things stuck out to me. One was that he got a lot of angry letters talking about how atrocious the Judiciary Committee hearings were. And it seems to me the gambit of having Alito's wife cry may have been one of the things that precipitated all this angry letters. The other thing was he accepted Alito's pretty flagrant baloney explanation of his speech at the Federalist Society about the Unitary Executive, where he said, I didn't mean what they mean. I mean what I mean. I mean just that the executive has power to execute, to do their own thing,
yeah, right,
on the cases that pertain to them, and not the broader analysis that the Unitary Executive has in the Federalist Society, which means he's practically, you know, head potentate, monarch, et cetera, et cetera. And he took Alito on his word, and that was just ridiculous.
Bush has gotten two extremely business-friendly members of the Supreme Court in place, and people like Barack Obama have not done what they could have done to stop it. Obama attacked the notion of filibustering before he ever finally came around, when it was perfectly safe to do so,
right,
to vote in favor of it. Now, look, there were, in fact, 42 votes cast against Alito. 42 votes would be enough to sustain a filibuster. So the people we've really should be upset with here in the Senate are those who said, oh yes, I'm going to vote against Alito, but I won't support a filibuster. Now, if they really wanted to use the effective tactic they had to stop Alito, they could have done it. They chose not to. And the wishy-washiness, the wanting to have it both ways, is pointed up again by our junior senator, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I pretty much applaud our senior senator. Durbin, I thought, was quite good on it, but I don't know why he didn't persuade Reid to actually make it the statement. I think, well, we didn't say anything about the social farm. The only way last we recounted the Davos was because the faux pas of Kerry announcing his trying to get the filibuster going from Switzerland.
As if that
we
made
didn't
a difference.
Also mention the Venezuelan social farm, which is an important thing to keep track of.
We could also mention that the House voted this week to cut $39 billion out of the sort of social programs of one form and another, and there were only 13 Republicans who voted against it. One, I'm happy to say, was our own representative. So
don't get me started on Timmy.
There we go. Inshallah, we'll be back next weekend.